Yes, David Edelman. I'm on the faculty here at in Spurford School. I was also an undergrad at MIT. The main thing that comes to my mind hearing these seemingly overwhelming issues that you raise is the hope is public awareness, and I see the universities have a role to play there, and I'm worried at the moment, particularly at universities like this one, the recent restructuring that has to do with was done by a group over Washington Advisory Group, which is a right wing think tank. With a director as an advisor to the President of the United States. I'm worried, in situations like that, how is that possible? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I can't really talk about the details of what's happening here. I don't know anything about them. But there's, I know the situation in the United States better, and it's pretty similar in Europe to the extent that I followed it. There's a lot of pressure towards corporatizing the universities, giving them a kind of a general corporate top-down structure, to ensuring that they don't depart too much from, that they don't allow too much diversity of opinion except well to the right. That's been going on for years. It's intensifying now. A lot of it is a reaction to what happened in the 1960s. The 1960s were a democratizing period. They brought lots of people into the political arena who were usually passive and obedient, and that was terrifying to especially liberal elites. It's not the right wing. If you want to get a picture of it, one of the most important books that everyone should read, if you haven't read it already, is a book called The Crisis of Democracy, which was published in 1974. It's the first, in fact, the only important publication of the Trilateral Commission. Now, that's a commission of liberal internationalists from the trilateral societies, North America, Europe, Japan. You can get the complexion of it by the fact that they basically filled the Carter administration. It's that spectrum of opinion. The crisis of democracy that they that concerned them in all three regions was that there was too much democracy, that normally passive and apathetic populations, you know, young people, women, the elderly, farmers, workers, the groups that are called the special interests, meaning the entire population outside of the corporate sector, the special interests were becoming too engaged in public affairs. And that creates what they called an overload on the state. And they therefore called for more moderation in democracy. And they were particularly concerned with what they called, these are their words, the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young. That's schools, churches, universities, and so on. They simply weren't doing their job properly. They weren't indoctrinating the young successfully, as you could see from what was happening in the 60s. This wave of openness and democratization and freedom and rights and so on. So therefore, they said they have to do a better job of indoctrinating the young, and if not, the government will have to step in and force them to. I'm talking from the liberal end of the spectrum. I mean, over on the right, it's far more extreme. And since then, there's been a massive series of efforts to try to achieve these goals. They go all the way from the international economic system to particular measures of the kind you're talking about. The neoliberal economic arrangements, which were instituted roughly from that time, have as one of their main consequences, almost transparent consequence, is to reduce the threat of democracy. Now, you can debate the economic effects. I think they're mainly harmful, but at least that's debatable. But in the case of undermining democracy, it's just transparent. I mean, every single proposal, you can go through it if you want. And the same is true of many other things. So yes, this is part of it. There has to be better indoctrination of the young. Well, the young don't have to accept the indoctrination, and with corporatization or anything else, they can continue to be free and challenging and open and so on. Like, say, take my own university, for example. In the 1960s, MIT was sometimes called Pentagon University. It was literally almost 100% funded by the Pentagon. Nevertheless, it was the center, the academic center of anti-war resistance, not protest, resistance, organizing resistance. That can be done. And the students were very active and engaged. If you know things like ZNet, for example, or South End Press and so on, they just are all came out of that. And yeah, that can be done under whatever the conditions are. But the attempts are clear and understandable, and the resistance to them is crucial. I mean, when you say about awareness, it's certainly true. I mean, unless people in the West know about, say, to pick one case, the breakdown of the Fiskband Treaty and what that entails, unless they know that, unless they know what the reasons are for the current confrontation with Iran, the species is not going to survive very long. So yeah, that's important.
Next question. Do you just get one question each, please? Your name, please.
Yeah, my name is Piruz Danishmandi. My question is, would you say that the current wave of populist governments in Latin America would have a better chance of success? I mean, talking mainly in the governments of Chavez and Morales and so on, would have a better chance of success in standing up to the aggression and the bullying of the Godfather in the North than their predecessors did, such as the Arbenz government or Allende and Sandinistas?
Yeah, I think they have a much better chance for a lot of reasons. For one thing, because the West has become more civilized. Kinds of actions that the Kennedy administration could carry out without anybody even paying attention, or that the Reagan administration could carry out against substantial protest, would be much harder in the United States today, because the population is much less likely to tolerate it. The Iraq War was an interesting example. It's worth bearing in mind that the Iraq War is the first colonial war, basically, in hundreds of years of Western history. It's the first time that there was ever massive protest against a war before it was officially launched. It's never happened before. It wasn't enough to call it off, but it's a huge step. Furthermore, the fact that the Bush administration constructed such an unimaginable catastrophe in Iraq, I mean, the failure in Iraq is one of the worst catastrophes in military history. Now, that's sharply reduced their capacity to carry out aggressive action elsewhere. And my own guess, frankly, before the Iraq war, actually, I may have said that here in a video conference at the time, but my own guess was that the Iraq war would be over in about 3 days, that they'd send in a class from the MIT Electrical Engineering Department and get the electricity running again, and they'd probably leave a Salvador-style client state, and then they'd go on to attack the Andes. That was my guess at the time, but you know, they succeeded with an amazing combination of arrogance and ignorance and incompetence in converting what should have been the easiest military victory in history into one of the worst military catastrophes in history, so bad that they may actually lose control of Middle East oil. And that gives space to people elsewhere to carry out actions that would have been very hard otherwise. Those are some of the factors, but it's much more than that. By now, there are substantial, for the first time in its history, Latin America is developing internal contacts of a serious nature. I mean, until now, pretty much Latin America was oriented toward the conquerors. So the countries were, the road systems, the cultural systems, you know, the elites and everything, were oriented towards whatever the Western invader was. For the first time, they're beginning to integrate. It's a slow process, but it's proceeding. There's a South American trade bloc, Mercosur. Chavez's victory is having a big effect. The U.S. is horrified by it, can't do much about it. It's very popular in Latin America. It's winning support, tremendously popular in Venezuela. It's one thing they can do anything about. They tried with a military coup, had to back off. And it's having effects elsewhere. The Morales election in Bolivia is another. Throughout South America now, from Venezuela down to Argentina, sole exception is Colombia, there's a kind of a ferment going on. Some left-center governments. There's an indigenous movement for the first time, cross-national, from Bolivia up to Ecuador mainly, which is calling for an Indian nation. Many of them, incidentally, they want to control their own resources, which are substantial, and many of them don't even want those resources to be exploited. So there are plenty of peasants in Ecuador who don't see any reason to have their lifestyle destroyed so that people can drive, sit in SUVs and traffic jams in New York. You know, they have other goals in life. And this region is just getting out of hand. The United States doesn't know how to deal with it, can't deal with it. Furthermore, there are now South-South contacts going well beyond Latin America. So Latin America, South Africa, and India have integrated relationships. China, not only is a major trading partner of the European Union, maybe the leading trading partner now, but it's also becoming a much greater trading partner with Latin America, particularly Venezuela, but also the other exporters, Brazil and Chile. And they're beginning to invest, they're supporting, they're presenting a competing force to U.S. power in Latin America, which hasn't existed since the time when the British and the French controlled South America, so since the Second World War. Those are big changes in the world. In fact, you know, if you take a look at the whole picture of U.S. policy, the Bush administration has in fact driven the United States into an extremely dangerous situation. And you know, it's a kind of a wounded lion, which is the most dangerous kind. You don't know how they're going to react, but the wounds are severe. They are in a possibly losing control of Middle East oil resources, which would be just an incredible disaster for US-British planners. But same is happening in the Western Hemisphere. US intelligence had projected back in 2000 that the U.S. would, of course, control the Middle East, but it would rely for itself on more stable resources in the Atlantic Basin. That means West Africa and the Western Hemisphere. Well, the main ones are in Venezuela, and they're now losing. Of course, they're not really losing them, but Venezuela is beginning to diversify its exports, doesn't want to be reliant on the United States, it's exporting to China. Same is very likely to happen in Bolivia if things develop, biggest natural gas producer. The Bush administration has even succeeded in something which is almost inconceivable and takes real talent. They've alienated Canada. You know, I mean, like I say, that takes real genius. The Bush administration, there were NAFTA conflicts, you know, between Canada and the United States, and the United States lost in the NAFTA courts. So, of course, told NAFTA to get lost and told Canada to get lost. Well, you know, Canada's pretty obedient, but they weren't happy about that. And the Canadian Minister of Resources actually said that Canada might send part of the oil it sends to the United States to China, which is a pretty natural relationship. And that's the second biggest supplier to the United States in the Western Hemisphere, Venezuela the first. But you know, the consequences of all of this are extremely hard to predict, but it's it's of enormous significance for potential world affairs. But getting back to your original question, yeah, there's a lot of reasons for space for action that didn't exist before.
My name is Marcelo. I'm from Latin America, and just thank you for being 3 years ago in Porto Alegre with your wife, and it's an honor to have you here. And as a Latin American, just to say that. To see that you go constant around the world trying to spread this awareness, that my question goes to your latest book, Imperial Ambitions, which is our responsibility that we have, our privilege, that if we're talking about these Indians in Latin America, that they swim out of the colonial history of our problem that we have, and we solve it our own way. My question shock is I'm still a student here from DCU, and our privilege to be here to have all what we have in this Western world, why doesn't correlate with our responsibility that we have? We have a privilege to do it, and how we articulate these things into translating into away from the resistance, away from that resistance, how we change into a proactive activities into something that we have to change, and we are that 20% lucky that we are the privileged one. Why is not a movement to encourage that sparkle that we have to wake up sometime?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, people, I mean, probably everybody here, certainly me, come from a very privileged sector of the world. And privilege does offer opportunities. And opportunities confer responsibility. I mean, a wealthy, privileged person has responsibilities that go way beyond those of a peasant in Bolivia. That's transparent. So then you have a choice. Will you take up your responsibilities or will you abandon them? We certainly have them. We have the opportunities. We have the responsibilities. Will we be as courageous about it as, say, peasants in Bolivia or in southern Colombia or, you know, El Salvador or any place that's under the jackboot somewhere? And there's no answer to that. It's just a choice that we have. You can take up those responsibilities or abandon them. And there are plenty of people who are taking them up. I mean, as most of you know, I'm sure, in a couple of days there'll be another meeting of the World Social Forum, this time in Caracas. By now the World Social Forum has spawned regional and local social forums all over the world. This is a real mass movement, a popular movement, which has nothing like it in history. And it's the first, at least the seeds of the first genuine international. I mean, an international has been the dream of the left and the labor movement since its origins in the modern times. That's why every union is called an international. I mean, they aren't internationals, but that was the goal. There were abortive attempts to form internationals, destroyed mostly internally for all sorts of reasons. But this one is at least the seeds of a genuine one. It crosses regional lines, crosses class lines, as peasants, steel workers, educated, you know, professionals, working together for pretty common aims. With a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of commitment to doing things locally all over the world and getting together in regional conferences by now in several places at the same time regularly. Okay, those are the beginnings of real opportunities. How to carry them forward? Well, you know, at that point we're back to choice. There's certainly no magic keys about this. I mean, there's no secrets about it that anyone's been keeping from people. It just means regular, dedicated organizing and educating, educational activities and tactics which have to be adapted to whatever the particular circumstances and goals are. There's no formulas for it any more than there has been for making the enormous, winning the privileges we do have. I mean, they haven't been given by anyone. They've been won by constant struggle. Labor struggle, human rights struggle, women's struggles, and so on. Yeah, you win the privileges. Then you have a legacy and a choice. You can abandon the legacy or you can use it. And it's been that way all through history. That's the way it is now.
Hi, my name is Conor McGowan, and I'm affiliated to the Irish Socialist Network. Tonight's talk is on the quest for survival. In the more personal quest for human survival, many people attempt to enter Ireland to escape torture and desperate poverty. With racism on the rise in Ireland due to, amongst other things, the facilitation of open fascists here in the LNH, our government has succeeded in passing a referendum banning children of non-nationals from our country. As an anarchist yourself, and as somebody who expresses anti-elitist views, would you like to comment on why this government will bend over backwards to allow you into Ireland and turn down others whose very survival may well depend on entry into this country?
It's a question that answers itself, so I don't have to answer it. You know the answer. The question isn't, you know, we're not looking for an answer. The question is, what do you do about it? I mean, yes, those kind of barriers are going up all over the world. I don't know about Ireland, but they're certainly going up in the United States, European Union, elsewhere. And yeah, they're all really shocking. I mean, the barriers, and it's a very mixed story when you look. Take, say, the United States, the one I know best. There's pressures from elite groups, both to admit immigrants and to ban them, both. They want to admit them because they want cheap, exploitable labor, which will displace domestic labor and reduce their rights and wages. On the other hand, they want to keep them out for racist and other reasons. And so you get a mixture. So for example, take, say, the border with Mexico, which is the main, you know, the main border that's near permeable. Up until throughout its history, like most borders, it's been a very arbitrary border. Borders are established by conquest. You know, they're not given by God. And the Mexican border was established by conquest. The U.S. conquered half of Mexico. And it was a porous border. Pretty much the same people lived on both sides. They went up and back freely, fairly freely. It was changed in 1994 when NAFTA was passed, North American Free Trade Agreement, so-called. When it was passed in 1994, Clinton militarized the border for the first time. Why? Well, because it was anticipated that NAFTA, contrary to pretense, would be a disaster for Mexicans, as in fact turned out to be the case. Not for the rich, you know, a number of billionaires shot way up, but so did the poverty rate. And it was expected it would lead to, the neoliberal measures would lead to an influx of people trying to escape to the north, so they militarized the border. And by now it's like, it's really militarized. Hundreds of people are dying trying to get across. Agribusiness, others who want cheap labor, they want them to come across for ugly reasons. But they're the kind of pressures you're talking about to keep them out. There are struggles going on right where I live in Boston. Actually, my daughter teaches nearby colleges, leading some of them, to try to gain rights, to gain the rights of undocumented immigrants, to enable their children to go to school. I mean, you know, keeping them out of school is just unbelievable cruelty. I mean, they were brought in to be exploited. Now the children are being kept out of school. Happens to be technically illegal, but getting the universities to obey the law on this is not easy. So yes, these are the kinds of constant struggles that go on everywhere, take different forms in different places. I mean, when Spain was brought into the European Union, there was a kind of a tacit agreement that part of Spain's obligation would be to be a border police, you know, keep people from North Africa from getting into Europe. Well, Spain wants to agree to that. They can do it. It's not very pretty. And yeah, that's happening everywhere.
My name is Hamid Reza Khodabakhshi. I'm affiliated with Dublin Institute of Technology Student Union. Let me just first welcome you on behalf of all DIT students to Dublin, Professor Chomsky, and we hope very much we'd be honored with your presence someday soon in our university. My question is about your speech tonight. You mentioned the elections in June in Iran and democracy, which is a very strange word in Iran. I would just like to get your view about the new president. As you know, he leads a very right-wing government in Iran, and after President Khatami, that he was more liberal and he was more international based on his policies. Like, what would be your view on that? And would you think that it's beneficial for the country? And how would your views be over the military action in Iran from United States after the new election?
Well, as far as I understand, Ahmadinejad's appeal was on social issues. He was felt, rightly or wrongly, to be someone who might be concerned with the extreme needs of the poor and oppressed people. And that's where he got the vote from. The reformers, you know, the people who I would prefer on civil rights grounds, themselves conceded that they had lost the population, they weren't speaking for them. I mean, they weren't interested in the issues that the elites were interested in. They were interested in survival. And Ahmadinejad gave the impression of being rightly or wrongly, committed to social issues. Incidentally, that's part of the Islamic fundamentalist appeal throughout much of the world. I mean, take groups like Hamas, say, or the radical Islamists in Egypt, or almost everywhere. Whatever you think about their views, they're mostly honest. They're not extremely corrupt, you know. If a poor person has a sick kid and wants to go to a clinic, they can go to one of the radical Islamists' clinics and they'll be treated. They go to a government clinic, you know, if they find a nurse there, they're lucky. And if it is, she's there or a doctor's there, you know, he probably doesn't care anyway. Well, you know, that kind of thing makes a difference over time. It does lead to appeal. That's been a large part of the appeal of Islamic fundamentalist forces. And I, to the extent that I understand Iran, which is not profound, I should say, I think that's the appeal that Ahmadinejad has had. On the international scene, he's kind of a disaster for Iran. But on the domestically, you can see the basis for the appeal. However, whatever's going on in Iran, you know, that's really not our concern. That's their concern. What our concern ought to be is, why are we pressing Iran in the most dangerous possible direction? For example, in the way that I mentioned, by EU cowardice, European Union cowardice, in refusing to live up to the compact they made with Iran with regard to enriching nuclear materials. I mean, you can't condemn Iran for breaking the bargain if the European Union refuses to accept its part of the bargain under U.S. pressure. And their Iranian demands are very sensible. I mean, if Iran was threatening anyone anywhere near the extent that the U.S. is threatening Iran, we'd probably think they should be wiped out. You know? I mean, whatever horrible statements Ahmadinejad is making, suppose that he were adding to it a credible threat to bomb the United States or bomb Israel or carry out terrorist acts within them, and was preparing very visibly to do so and developing capacity to do so. Well, how long do you think he would last in that case? Okay, we know what would happen. That's what we're doing. And the European Union, under U.S. pressure, is refusing to live up to its firm commitment.